Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello there. You have found First Rounders, Nature Biotechnology's podcast, and I am Brady Huggett. I'm the host of this show. Okay, the guest today, Katrine Bosley. She was scheduled to come into New York, into our studio there, but then the pandemic hit, and we all went into pause. And so we talked about this and readjusted and did this through audio video. I do not prefer it this way. I would much prefer to be sitting across a table from someone. I think you'd get a better conversation, but this worked. She's really easy to talk to, and she has had an amazing career in biotech, beginning almost quite literally at the bottom. Her first job in biotech was an administrative assistant, and she has worked her way all the way up to be, she was CEO of the highly visible CRISPR company Editas, with lots of stops in between. So we talked about that, and we talked about when she got to Cornell, her experience there sort of turned her away from an academic life, and she began to look for a field where she could work at the intersection of science and something, and she wasn't quite sure what, but that ended up being biotechnology, this intersection of science and business, really. And yeah, we talked about her growing up as a Midwestern girl, as she says, in Ohio. All that and much more. Anything else to get you ready? No, I don't think so. So here it is, your First Rounders podcast with Katrine Bosley. Listen up. It's a little echoey, but this is, I mean, this is how life goes now.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and we've been, you know, learning what everybody's backgrounds at home look like, and
yeah.
Lighting and all those things.
Children and pets running through the screen.
Children and pets running through the screen. Yep.
So are you ready?
I'm ready.
I do not know where you grew up.
So I actually grew up in Ohio, just east of Cleveland in a town called Mentor. Uh-huh. So suburb Cleveland, and went to public high school there. A wonderful place to grow up. Still have some family there, and Midwestern girl.
Yeah. So why that area? Was that like the long line of your family there, or I don't know.
Couple of things. On my mother's side, my ancestors had been in Ohio for, gosh, they were some of the first settlers in Ohio, little tiny farm town called Homer, Ohio, which is a very small town in central Ohio, going back 6, 7, 8 generations.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And then on my dad's side, also from Ohio generally, but he grew up in that town, Mentor, where I grew up, and his parents, my grandparents, were there, and they had a nursery business. So there were a lot of nurseries in that area of Ohio, both in Mentor and then over into Madison. It was a good place. If you're growing plants where you want to grow them in a tough winter climate, so they're very hardy, That's a good place to do it. And so there were quite a lot of nursery businesses there, not anymore, of course, but that was my grandfather's business, and I grew up running around the nursery and, you know, doing little piecework like any kid does when there's a family business, like sticking cuttings and weeding and stuff like that. It's a wonderful place to grow up.
But so, I mean, I actually don't know really anything about nurseries. So does that mean you have a big portion of land and then you cultivate plants and sell them, or?
Yes.
Or that is, okay.
Exactly, so yes. So it was wholesale, so not retail, it was wholesale. And my dad grew a couple different species. So he and my grandfather both grew a lot of rhododendrons, some azaleas. My grandfather grew a lot of holly. My dad didn't do holly, but he also did some houseplants, some ivy and other houseplants. So a bit of a mixture. And like any business, you know, you figure out what's selling and, you know, what your customers are looking for. In this case, the customers being more the retail nursery shops. But it was, you know, there were greenhouses and, you know, I still every time I step into a greenhouse, it just takes me back that sort of warm, humid air that smells like plants growing. You know?
That earthy smell, yeah.
That earthy smell, it's wonderful, yeah.
So you're saying, so they sold wholesale to the retailers then?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Wow. Okay. So that sounds like a pretty big operation.
It was. And they also did, each of them did some hybridizing as well. So for example, there's my grandfather did a little bit more than my dad, but they both did some. There's a beautiful yellow rose named after my grandmother. There's a rhododendron named after my grandmother. There's a rhododendron named after my Aunt Ginny and another one after my Aunt Patricia. So, you know, that was not a little bit more of a side part of what he did, because I think he just, you know, he really loved plants and it was interesting and fun. And I think all nurserymen did a little bit of that, at least back in those days. But, you know, I think it's interesting because, you know, everybody grows up, whatever the context you grow up in, it feels normal because that's the only thing you know. Yeah. And so for me, normal was just, you know, your dad, your grandfather each kind of run their own business and are doing these creative things that, you know, yes, sure. My grandfather's hybridized roses and named them after my grandmother. Of course.
Yeah.
That's normal. You know?
So he was, he would breed roses, come up with a brand new strain no one ever seen before, and then he'd be able to give it a name because he created it.
Exactly.
Oh, yep. That is cool.
Yeah.
All right. I mean, I was going to ask how you got your interest in science, but it's kind of seeming clear how you got your interest in science.
Yeah. And also it's just, it was part of what we grew up with. My mother is actually very artistic. She was originally an art teacher, but then later she worked for the local public television station, WVIZ, as the staff artist. But we were also a family where science was cool. And, you know, actually also, so Ohio geologically is essentially a former inland ocean bed. And so there's a lot of limestone there, and there are limestone quarries that are full of fossils. And in fact, I'm looking at my desk right now. I have this little fossil of two brachiopods that came from Medusa Quarry in Ohio. And when we were kids, we'd sometimes go there like on a family weekend. And on the weekends when they weren't working the quarry, you could go in and just chisel out some fossils. And, you know, that was just the thing we did.
And then that fossil was yours. You could bring it home and you'd have a collection.
Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah. It was amazing. And trilobites and crinoids and thousands of brachiopods. I mean, it was just like literally so many fossils in there. You're guaranteed to find stuff. You probably can't do it these days anymore. But back in the day, they're like, yeah, sure, go ahead. Call out a couple pounds of rocks.
do you remember, you know, finding something that was beyond your normal fossil, like an actual?
Yeah. Well, so these are all ocean fossils, right? Because this is literally an ocean floor, the bed of an ocean. Look, for me, every single one of them was absolutely amazing. And, you know, certainly when you found one that was more perfect, when it was more complete, I do remember this one brachiopod that was also sort of the edges of it were tapered. So brachiopod is essentially kind of like a clam, but they come in different shapes and sizes, just like clams come in different shapes and sizes. Mm-hmm. I found one that was really beautiful. And for some reason, it was also sort of pearlized. I'm not quite sure what, maybe siliconized. I'm not sure what the chemicals or the actual rocks were, but it had just this beautiful sheen, not just the perfect shape, but this beautiful sheen with it as well. But I have to say, the critters that were always most exciting to find was if you found a really good trilobite. Because a lot of times you could find like the little edge of a trilobite, you know, just like a little bit of its back or a little bit of its eye. But sometimes you could find the whole animal, and that was always very exciting.
I have to ask this before we go on. What does the local artist do for the TV station?
Well, so remember, this is going to be back in the sort of 60s and 70s. Uh-huh. So pre-computer stuff, right? So every time you needed to do, for example, station identification, you know, this is channel 25, WVIZ, you need a something that says that. So there'd be things like that. Also, for whatever they were producing locally. So certainly there were programs that they got from national public television and they would broadcast them locally, but you would also produce things locally. And they did some kids shows and some science shows and some local news programs. So, you know, she built the set for the local news program.
Oh, cool.
There was some show they did for kids that involved something about dentistry. And I just remember she did like paper mache Mongo size teeth, and you could take the teeth out. And so on the show, they could show you like what you do when you're brushing your teeth and flossing your teeth. And one had a little cavity and one was perfect and one had a big, you know. So it was all kinds of different things, and it's in all kinds of different media as well. It's just whatever needed to be done. And there were folks there who could also help build things. So she might like design a set and then the builders would build it. But, you know, she was right in there as well, painting things and putting things together. Later in her career, she actually transitioned into long distance learning. So public television, there's all the stuff we watch when we watch Nova or whatever other programs we all like. But public television often has multiple channels, and particularly, so this would be more in the 80s when she worked there. And again, pre-internet, right? So this was the original distance learning. There would be multiple channels that WVIC, and they would broadcast educational programming. And then there would also be supporting materials, so teachers could have the classroom piece, there would be the broadcast piece, and they would put it together so it would be a more holistic, vibrant lesson for kids. And it was a way to, you know, get more and new and exciting materials into the hands of teachers and into the hands of kids. And so my mother was part of both the outreach to the schools to help the teachers, you know, learn how to use these programs and the curricula, and then also helping develop that curricula within the WVIZ context.
Yeah, I mean, both of those jobs, I would never have known that they existed, and they sound like great jobs.
It was amazing, and it was amazing too, just to, again, be surrounded by that as a kid, right? Because, for example, it's a rainy Saturday, and you're 7 years old, and you say, "Mom, I'm bored." Our mother's answer was usually, "Well, go down in the basement to the make it drawers and pull something out." So there was literally this little, I think it was made out of cardboard, like probably got it at Kmart or something. It's like a fold it together little set of drawers, right? Mm-hmm. So this is not fancy, but there's just all kinds of cool, creative, artistic raw materials, essentially, you know, pastels and feathers and plaster of Paris and 1,000. And so she had her art supplies. As children, we weren't allowed to touch mother's art supplies because, you know, she had the nice brushes and professional stuff. But you know, we would do plaster casting of raccoon tracks in the mud. Or we would do at Halloween, we would make our own paper mache masks and, you know, make these wild monster masks. And that was our, you know, part of our Halloween costume.
Yeah.
So there were all these sort of just creative, normal aspects of our childhood that, you know, as I have two brothers, and, you know, obviously now that we're grown, we really appreciate what all that was like. But I think for all of us, it just wanted to imbue a real love of aesthetics and that being part of day-to-day life. But also, it just, you know, you can make things.
Yeah.
You can do things. You know, that experimental mindset, I think, without, and I don't know that they were, either my parents were trying to explicitly imbue that in us, but I think it's just how they were and therefore how we are.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're getting sort of this, on the one side, you're seeing a little bit how businesses run, right? Your dad's nursing.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. And my grandparents were really good at exposing us to that. And I remember my older brother, he's the most entrepreneurial of the family, and he started his own business when I think he was like 8 or 9 years old, and selling plants by the roadside. And actually the sheriff stopped by one day and asked him if he had a vendor's license.
Of course, right,
And of course my brother's like, no, sir, I don't. And he's like, well, you need one. He went and got a vendor's license, right?
He did?
He did, yeah.
Wow.
And I remember too, my grandmother wrote him a letter of advice on running a business that he has to this day, of course. And you know, it's fabulous advice. Fundamentals: pay attention to your customer, understand your expenses, work hard, be honest. I mean, you know, fundamentals, but you know, you could read that today and
they're still, yeah,
do you good thing.
I mean, they're absolutely fundamental for a reason, right? And it's because they're necessary.
Exactly.
Yeah. Just for, yep, one more thing on your mother, but so she had her own supplies, as you said. Was she also like, you know, painting, mm-hmm, on her own or creating sculptures and art on her own?
Yeah. So she did some when she was younger, you know, as she's a mother and working and everything else, there wasn't as much time for that. Yeah. However, it ended up showing up in day-to-day life in a whole bunch of other ways. Like, you know, I remember, for example, when I was in elementary school and we had the talent show at Hopkins Elementary, and my mother was part of the PTA, and she said, well, we should make t-shirts. Again, remember, this is in the 70s, right? Today, of course, that's easy to do. Yeah. And everybody's like, what do you mean we should make t-shirts? And she said, oh, we'll just do a silk screen. I can do it, no problem. And then she got everybody involved because, you know, she designed the silk screen and she taught us all how to do the silk screening of the shirts. Uh-huh. But we all had like designed silk screen t-shirts for this talent show, all that kind of thing.
Yeah, I love that, because when you're a kid like that, especially back then, it's like t-shirts come from a company. You don't, yeah, make your own t-shirt.
You don't
That's
make
kind
them.
Of amazing, right? Right.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm thinking some college is coming up for you, and how did you, were you already thinking, well, okay, I want to get into some sort of science?
Yeah, I was just really drawn to biology. I remember sometime when I was like, I don't know, middle school or something, reading something about bioluminescence and thinking, that's what I want to do. I want to study bioluminescence.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't realize that, you know, that a lot of that was already figured out, but I did love science, and my high school was actually an excellent public high school, and there were a couple of the biology teachers there who just kind of pushed an extra mile, and they created this set of rather specialized advanced biology classes that you could take as a senior. And so mostly sort of physiologically oriented, you know, the renal system, the nervous system, things like that. Mm-hmm. But there's also one on microbiology, and there's one on genetics. And, you know, again, this is the mid 80s. So it is going back a ways. Mr. Korchak and Mr. Covetta. And, you know, they just kind of invented these classes out of their own initiative. But being able to be taken a level deeper into the biological sciences was, for me, just very inspiring. And so I knew I wanted to go that direction generally, but I also wanted to go to a school that broadly had, you know, good general liberal arts opportunities, mm-hmm, and was a kind of bigger, vibrant campus. My high school was big, so I'm like, well, college should be bigger. And then beyond that, you know, Ohio has some great schools, but I felt like you're supposed to go away,
right,
to college.
Right.
So through all of that, I kind of narrowed it down to a handful that I applied to, and ended up at Cornell, which was totally amazing. I remember visiting the campus and just falling in love with it.
So was that your top school going in, or did you apply to a lot of schools?
I can't remember. I think I applied to 3 or 4. You know, the process was so different than it is today, because,
yeah,
there was no common application. So, you know, every application was a good 4 or 5 essays.
Yeah. Yeah. So these two teachers you had, you know, you're saying that he's sort of the genetics guy. He said, well, I want to do a course on genetics for my high school kids. Cause that, I don't think that was not, I mean, that wasn't on the curriculum when I was in high school.
No. Yeah. It was unusual. It was unusual. I mean, it's just the initiative of those teachers. And I mean, I think it speaks well of the whole school.
Yeah.
I remember the principal, Peggy Hanrahan, was incredibly well respected, and it was a good school system, right? I mean, it was, you know, just a sort of straight middle class community. It wasn't a particularly wealthy community at all. But it was, it's interesting. Part of it was that, and I know this partly because my mother was very involved in educational matters, of course. And the, in the, I think it was in the early to mid 60s, a lot of these communities were growing and they needed more capacity at the high school. So they're kind of outgrowing their existing high schools. And the town next door chose to make two smaller high schools. So each graduating class of, like, you know, call it 300 students. But Mentor chose to make one big high school. So my graduating class was about 700 kids.
Oh, wow.
And that was like, that was small. That was a small class. So sometimes they went up to 900 or so. So it's a big school. You know, obviously it's a, you know, some people say, well, didn't you feel lost? And I'm like, well, no, you find your niche, but it's certainly a different experience than a smaller, more intimate school. So,
yeah. I mean, so there were obviously people that you did not know in your high school and even your class, I'm sure. Course. Right. Yeah. So when you go to Cornell, did it meet your expectations? I mean, you fell in love with it. Did it live up to it?
Yeah. It was amazing. I mean, even beyond, I think, what I had anticipated. And it's funny because, I mean, I had in mind that I was going to study science, biology, probably focus on genetics, and then go on and get a PhD and go into academic research. That was my path.
Yeah.
Super, super excited about it. And, you know, part of my financial aid package was some work study funding. And I'm like, okay, I need a job. And let's get a job in a lab. You know, why not? Let's get in that environment and start to see what it's like. So I got a job as a lab assistant in the plant disease diagnostic laboratory. Mm-hmm. We were plant doctors, basically. We would get, so Cornell's part of the Cooperative Extension of New York State, and we would get disease plant samples from anywhere around the state, anybody that wanted to send it in through the Cooperative Extension. And then we would diagnose what was wrong with it, send them a letter back. So wonderful way to kind of like get exposed to a lot of stuff. And it was in the plant pathology department. So lab across the hall, they were world experts in viral diseases of corn.
Oh, wow.
Upstairs, bacterial diseases of crab apple and so on and so forth. And I spent the summer there. I worked full time during the summer, all that kind of stuff. But through that, I also kind of realized what it is actually like to do research as a career, particularly through the summer I was there when I was doing it full time. And I realized, actually, maybe that's not quite the right thing for me. And specifically the you know, diving deep in what felt to me more narrowly in one particular area, which is, of course, the hallmark of science.
Right.
Whereas I realized I was more interested in how things interconnect. So I applied to this program that's just a small program at Cornell called the College Scholar Program. And it's basically, if you think that your intellectual interests don't fit any of the other bajillion majors you could possibly have at Cornell, because Cornell's a big place and there's a lot of different things you can major in. But if none of those satisfy you, you can make up your own. And so I applied and I basically was like, look, I'm interested in the, I think my initial approach was, I want to do scientific filmmaking. And I'm interested in the intersection of science and film. I'm thinking like Nova, right? Who doesn't want to make Nova films, right?
Yeah.
And so they accepted me. But the thing is, once you're in the program, you don't have to stick with that original idea. And I took filmmaking. I realized that I wasn't very good at it, and I didn't love filmmaking.
But so the idea then is that you would say, I want to make scientific films, and they would say, well, okay, we have a film department and we have science courses, and we can sort of put together, string together curriculum from these different areas of the school, and that will be your education, like that.
No, it was up to me. It was up to me to string it together. Oh, so one thing is, once you're in the program, there's two things. In order, you have absolutely no requirements in order to graduate except a certain total number of credits and a senior thesis. You don't have to have a declared major of any kind. You don't have like a distribution or a humanities or a language. None of those requirements, they all go away. And it's up to you to decide what you're taking every semester and to make it add up to something meaningful for you.
I feel like everybody would probably apply to this program. There must be, I mean, the freedom sounds incredible.
Well, and the thing is, it's, it's not for everybody, right? I mean, I think some people did fantastically with the majors that they picked and, you know, diving deeply into that area where they had passion and interest. And, you know, majors are can provide great structure as well. I will say that to me, what I ended up doing, I took a ton of science and I essentially completed a biology major anyway, but I took a lot of things. I took some education courses. I took some law courses. I took some finance courses. I did take filmmaking courses. And through all of that, I was trying to look at what's the intersection between science and something else. And I wasn't quite sure what that was going to be. By the time I was a senior, I had really kind of honed in on this biotech industry looks fascinating. Wow, you can act, this is where medicines come from. Mm-hmm. And they're like, it's not just the Mercks of the world, but there are little companies that do this stuff. And, you know, I was like, how do I get into that?
So then, what you decided upon was I'm going to go to this intersection of science and business, really. I mean, that's what biotech is.
Yeah. And it's interesting because my undergraduate path was, there was a bit of, you know, trial and error exploration. I think the key was that every semester, when everybody else is thinking, what do I have to take, you know, to pick their courses for the next semester? I wasn't thinking that. I was thinking, what do I want to take? And it was a fundamentally different mindset. And I really had to justify to myself why that course and not this other one. Because when you say, what do I get to take? Everything looks interesting.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you have to really think about what direction you're going and what you've already learned. You know, where does that point you? So, yeah. So by the time I graduated in 1990, which was not the best economy.
Right.
And, you know, there's also, as most people know, there's very few kinds of companies that come to recruit on campus. It's just, you know, most of the jobs out there aren't the kinds where they come to recruit on campus. So I graduated unemployed. Yay. And I'm like, how do I get into biotech? What I eventually figured out, again, remember pre-internet, was that biotech primarily existed in San Francisco and Boston.
Right.
Nobody's going to hire a new college graduate long distance, right, especially in that economy. And I needed to just be present and show up in one of those cities and be there if I wanted to get into the industry. So I ended up, I had one friend from high school who was living in Boston. So I moved to Boston with whatever I could fit in my, you know, 12-year-old car. Mm-hmm. And I got my first job through a want ad in the Boston Globe.
I was going to ask about this. I mean, even being in Boston and the industry being as young and smaller as it was then, I don't know how you crack the industry just rolling out of college with a bio degree.
Well, it's, I will tell you too, my first position was as an administrative assistant. And it was a little hard for me to realize that was where I needed to start because, you know, graduate, we have grand plans of how we're going to launch into the world. I will say first and foremost, respect everybody who does that job. It's a hard job.
Yeah.
But what was more important was that, you know, I was in the right environment, right? I was learning the jargon. I was reading, BioWorld existed then. You read the trade press and you start to hear about this company. And you know, literally I was learning things like, what's a clinical trial? You don't learn back in that time. You didn't learn that in college. Yeah. These days, I'm sure they have how biotech works is like a class, but you know, learning all some very fundamental basics and, you know, paying the rent, paying off my student loans, like I'm in the right environment. And the company that I was with wasn't a terribly strong company. So that was, you know, I also learned a little bit about how do you assess what's a strong organization. But it also meant that I was around when about a year later, a position opened up at Alkermes.
Oh, so who was the other company?
You've never heard of them. They're called ImRank.
No, I haven't. You're right.
Just one of thousands of little companies that just didn't quite go anywhere.
Yeah.
Which, you know, it's not an uncommon tale, right?
Yeah.
But the thing was that, you know, I was here and I was paying the rent when this position opened up at Alkermes. So, you know, being in the right environment so that you can be there when the opportunity happens, that's part of it, right? Alkermes also came through one ad. But Alkermes at the time was still private. It was about, I don't know, 25 employees maybe.
I mean, Richard Posse, yeah, right.
See, he was running. He had just joined about a month before. He had just joined as CEO, so he was new to the organization as well. And I was Carol Gloff hired me as a regulatory affairs assistant, which is essentially, you know, to put together the IND. Man, she had courage to hire me to do that because I was not a regulatory affairs expert. But my senior thesis in college was about the development of regulation of recombinant DNA technology.
There you go.
It was all about Asilomar and how that led to the NIH Recombinant DNA Advisory Committee, etc. I remember reading the transcripts of the City of Cambridge City Council meetings where they debated this and how Cambridge had put together a diverse committee of you know, because remember, Cambridge is this not such a big city.
Yeah.
And on either end of it, it's got like two of the pioneers between Harvard and MIT of this technology. And they're like, it's sort of the ultimate town gown challenge of you're doing what in my backyard?
Yeah.
And I mean, to this day, if you want to do anything with recombinant DNA in Cambridge, you need a city permit. Now, these days, it's obviously quite straightforward, but it stems from those early days when, you know, people were worried about the technology. And I joke that, you know, you go to Cambridge City Hall and that's where you get your parking permit and your dog permit and your recombinant DNA permit and, you know.
Yeah.
But I also thought...
There was a lot of fear around it back then, honestly, right? I mean,
And very, very understandable fear.
Yeah.
It was a brand new technology. You could imagine good and bad uses. Tons of analogies to CRISPR,
of analogies. Yeah.
I think one of the fascinating things about what Cambridge did and one of the reasons it was, I think successful is really the right characterization, was that basically the city said, right, we're going to put together a committee of people from diverse backgrounds, you know, not a bunch of scientists, and we're going to ask them to look at this. I think what was important about that was, number one, you know, obviously they had to get up to speed and understand the technology, which they did. Mm-hmm. So one is, it's possible to get up to speed and understand it, right? That's not an insurmountable thing. So people can absolutely understand these kinds of technologies. And yeah, they brought religious perspectives and community perspectives and business perspectives and all these different perspectives. And they were able to have a robust dialogue and come to a view about what would be constructive for Cambridge. And it worked, you know, the system worked.
Yeah, it did work.
That's the thing.
Yeah.
They did put a permitting system in place, and frankly, it did not stifle the science. It provided a framework and let it flourish.
That's like, there's two things. One, this kind of like folklore at this point, but the rumor was that Amgen was placed in Thousand Oaks, so that in case, if there was some sort of breach in the lab, that whatever they were creating would blow out to sea. I mean, that's the rumor, right?
Yeah.
This is how long ago, and they were like, we don't know what this company's doing. But so from there, you went to Biogen? Is that right?
No, I actually went from there to Highland Capital Partners. I worked in venture capital for a couple of years. And it was interesting because I hadn't been looking for it. And Alkermes was an amazing experience. It was, you know, the very heady days of the 91-92 IPO market, the company went public, they did a follow-on, Mike Landino, CFO, who was excellent, Rich was excellent, it was a great team. It was an exciting company and an exciting time to be there. I got a call from a headhunter, so I was far enough in my career that somehow a headhunter found me. I think it was a former college friend of mine. She called and about this position and Michelle was her name. Michelle wasn't interested, but remembered it sounded like something I did. So somehow they tracked me down. And this is like definitely before LinkedIn and all these other things. So she tracks me down and it's for an analyst position at a venture capital firm. I didn't really know much about venture other than they invest in biotech, but I really didn't know much about it. But I did think, you know, it might be helpful in the long run to understand the capital side of the equation. And, you know, no downside to having a conversation. It ended up being a really wonderful experience, but a good fit because what they were looking for, and Bob Higgins is the partner that I worked for, he wanted somebody who was not fresh out of college, had a, you know, few miles on the road at least, but could do, you know, due diligence and keep track of portfolio company stuff and all the kinds of stuff an analyst would do at a venture capital firm. And so I joined there in 93 and spent a couple years there. Really fundamentally important for me long term for my career, because understanding how an investor thinks and why, how funds are structured and why, what the dynamics of a fund structure are and how that impacts the companies they invest in.
Yeah.
What does no sound like? No takes a lot of different forms. Rarely does it take the form of no, but understand how to hear when it's yes and when it's no. How are boards structured? How do boards work? Boards are a mystery for most people until they're sitting in a boardroom for the first time. Mm-hmm. And boards are a very different kind of organizational structure than the operational teams that you're part of if you're an employee of a company. So a lot of things that I got exposure to, that particularly later when I became CEO of Avalon and then beyond that, really gave me some context for thinking about the role of being a CEO, the role of being a board member, how to understand what's going on for the investors that you have or the investors that you're trying to attract. So some really fundamental lessons that stood me in good stead long term.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Yeah, it's interesting what you just said. Is this headhunter came to the company, they sort of, so well, they were in this, but referred it to you, and you thought, you know, this might be useful in the long run, which suggests that you had a long view for yourself. And was it one day I would like to run a company?
You know, I think that was always there in my head at some level. And that may be also where, kind of coming back to how I grew up, that felt like a very reasonable and normal thing to consider doing. Because actually both my grandfathers had done that. My mom's dad had passed when I was a baby, but he ran his own business as well. It did seem like a very normal kind of thing to consider doing. And I think where, you know, where it really stemmed from is that I like building things.
Yeah.
And, you know, not just running them. And that's important too. And some people are amazing at, like, totally, the trains always run on time. There's a beauty to people who are excellent at that. That's probably not my top strength. I'm good at building things and I like building things, and both, you know, physically as well as intellectually. And building a company seemed like a really normal thing to think about doing. I will say too, just to add one more layer to the, you know, what's around you as a kid is what's normal. So WVIZ, I mentioned where my mother works, that the CEO of WVIZ was a woman named Betty Cope. And she had founded WAV. She started that television station back in the, I guess, the late 50s, which is you know, those were the high-tech startups of the 50s, right? A television station, not just high-tech, but also from a business model. Like, what's the business model? And so Betty Cope, yes, my mother's boss, but also they had become good friends over the years. And so Betty Cope is one of these people in my life who's like, yeah, of course a woman can be a CEO.
Yeah.
And of something complicated and of something innovative. And, you know, it just, it is very much in my range of normal.
Yeah. I mean, that's so, those role models are so key. If you can see it when you're young, then you can envision for yourself. If you don't see it, it's hard to kind of
it's put harder. Yourself there. Yeah.
Yeah. So that, along those lines, if you're working in this VC now, and now you're seeing how companies are built, you're seeing how startups are funded.
So from Highland, I went to Biogen. Yeah. And that was in late 1995. A couple of things were going through my mind. So I'd been around the industry long enough at that point that I had some knowledge of the industry, right? But still a lot to learn. And I thought, you know, venture, it's been great, but I actually think I'm an operating company person. I just think that's, you know, I didn't really have that desire to kind of make investing be my career. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was surrounded by really great people. Bob was an amazing kind of mentor and educator about that business. But, you know, at some point you figure out like, hey, I know where I fit in the world. And where I fit in the world, I'm like, I think I'm an operating company person. And I said, okay, what I really want to do is have people around me I can learn from, because I got a lot more to learn, but I don't want to be in a place that's so big I'm in like a little cog in a very narrowly defined company. So I think big pharma felt too big for me. And I said, I also think someplace that one has is in charge of its own destiny, right? So this was a time period when you had the kind of emerging companies of Amgen, Biogen, Genetics Institute. You know, there was a handful of them. But you had ones like Genetics Institute was majority owned by American Home Products. And in my mind, I'm like, well, I'm not sure they really control their own destiny.
Right.
So the two companies that really emerged the most from that thinking were Amgen and Biogen. And I did talk to both of them. The thing with Biogen, though, was that it was right on the cusp of launching its first product, Avonex. And I thought, you know, it's going to be amazing to be part of a company when it goes to that one-time transition. It only does it once, from R&D to R&D plus commercial.
Yeah.
I said, to be there at a time when all that's happening, that would be amazing. And so I joined actually a group that John Maraganore was putting together at the time to do business development and program management kinds of roles. And then over the next, I think I was there 8+ years. I think I had, you know, 7 different jobs and 5 different bosses, or 5 and 7, something like that. But it was a time of fantastic growth. Mm-hmm. And when you are in a growing organization, it puts a lot of opportunities in front of you. So while I was there, I did a bunch of deals. So I really learned how to do business development there. I spent a couple of years based out of the European office, living in Paris, which was awesome.
Wow, yeah.
but doing, you know, working with a lot of different biotech companies in Europe broadly, because I was doing business development there. So really got to know the European biotech community much better. I spent a year doing the corporate strategic long range plan. So how do you put all those pieces together? And I spent a couple years in commercial, because at some point I'm like, you know, I feel like I should know where revenue comes from. So I worked for Paul Clancy and Rob Perez. So yeah, it was a great experience.
I mean, but the thing you just said now too, like I should figure out where revenue comes from. I mean, that is, again, you actively trying to collect all parts that are required to run a company. Yeah. I mean, not everybody would do that, I don't think. Some people go, my job's pretty good. And but you were like actively trying to collect the information.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, we're all late, or at least I think, you know, if you're learning, it's always more fun.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, to do that, you're going to have to sometimes put yourselves in positions that are where you feel uncomfortable and in over your head.
So then, I mean, at some point you leave there and you go to AdNexus. How does that happen?
Yeah. Well, it was really a bit of self-reflection that the company had gone through the merger with IDEC. Mm-hmm. And about a year post IDEC, you know, it had gotten quite a bit bigger. And I'd always imagine myself going back to, and this is where, you know, your point, was I thinking of running a company someday? I think it was always in my head, but, you know, getting back to a smaller company environment where you're really building something was always in my mind as well. And, you know, Biogen felt like a big company to me. And I said, you know, I think I'm ready to get back to a small environment. And I've accumulated a lot more skills. I think I could really help build it in a way that when I was just coming out of Highland, I didn't have as much operational skills I thought I needed to really make an impact at a small company.
Yeah.
But 8 years later, I knew a lot.
Yeah.
And so I said, okay, I think it's time. What I did do though, and I've done this a few times now, is I thought, you know, life is important too. There's more to life than just career. And so I actually took some time off, because the other thing I didn't know quite what small company I wanted to go to, although I had a number of relationships and so ways to kind of investigate. But this was 2004, and there was a lot emerging in China and India with regard to biotech, and I was curious as to what was really going on, not just what you read, but what was really going on. And so I figured out a person who's a friend of mine who was over there, and it basically finagled a way to spend some time in India, hanging out with some different biotech people and doing a little bit of pro bono consulting for a small academic institution there, just to try to get a feel for what was going on in biotech in India, and is that a direction I wanted to go? Ultimately, what I realized from that was that was more, it was really developing as a CRO industry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And while that can be a great business and a great industry, you know, I wanted to be in translation of exciting new science.
Yeah.
I'd spent a lot of time with, you know, those kinds of programs and scientists at Biogen, and I loved that. So, you know, scary because it's so much unknown, but that new science transitioning into the clinic, into really being a medicine, that was the journey I wanted to be on. And that gave me a lot of focus when I got back here as to what kind of company was going to be the right fit for me.
I mean, so when I'm sort of looking at what happens for your career, at Nexus Happens, where you join as a vice president, that company
yep.
is eventually bought by Bristol Myers for, I think, like
yep.
$430 million or something. So that's a great exit, right? So you're like, okay, you just saw that
yep.
happen. And then I think your next
yep.
company is Avila. So
yes.
there
yes.
you're a CEO. You brought in as a CEO. And I want to talk about that in a second. But also what happens is that's
yeah.
bought by Celgene for
yeah.
you know, $350, I think, up front, and a total of like $925 if everything pays out. So again, like now,
yes.
now you've all these things that you've learned are coming together. You understand, you see how the venture capital money goes in,
yep.
it comes back out, right? Here's you've had two exits. And then Editas, eventually
yeah.
you have another exit with an IPO, right?
Yeah.
And it's kind of like those three, it's a really good track record.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because I think if you go into any company or role thinking about that, you set yourself up to fail. I mean, I went into each one of those companies because, you know, first and foremost, I fell in love with the science and I thought it was really cool.
Yeah.
You know, there's just that moment where you're like, oh, that's cool. Number one. Number two, there are good people around the table.
Yeah.
You know, in the company, investors, et cetera, just high quality, experienced, talented, committed people. And then you dive in and you try to make that vision real. And if you're focused on exit, you're going to miss opportunities. But also the thing is, there's so much that's outside of your control. You don't control whether somebody approaches you about acquisition. You don't control the capital markets.
Yeah.
You may need to react. Well, you will need to react to those things. But if you really want to make those medicines, and the way you want to make those medicines is to create a new company to do that because you feel like that's the most effective way to make those medicines, then how do you put all these puzzle pieces together to achieve that goal? Now, along the way, particularly with regard to acquisition, because I would often get asked the question at Avila, you know, are you looking to be acquired or are you building for the long term? Which is sort of a loaded question. Right. And I struggled with it for the longest time because it felt like the wrong question. And I understood where it was coming from, but I'm like, that's not the right question. So at one point I was forced to really sit down and think about like, why do I think it's the wrong question? What is it that I think about it? And ultimately what I came to is this: you need to build for the long term. That is the only strategy. Along that path of building value, somebody may approach you and say, hey, we would love for you to be part of us. And then you're going to be forced to answer the question, is that a better way to achieve that value and make those medicines and reach that goal? But the only way you're going to be able to even consider that question is if you know what it looks like to go along yourself. Now, there may be pressures that push you one way or the other, where are your investors, what's the market, all those things are going to influence ultimately the decision. But acquisitions, I don't think acquisitions really a strategy.
Yeah. Yeah. I find this fascinating, right? I can't. So when you said, you know, don't ever think about the exit, I was so surprised because I assumed that every time a venture capitalist puts money in a company, they are telling you over and over and over that they need that exit, right? And
well, it's not quite. I mean, it's certainly their thing, but that is their job, right? Their job is to return capital to their limited partners. And of course they bring it up. And of course the topic comes up, and I don't ignore it. Being a responsible steward of capital is incredibly, incredibly important part of a CEO's yeah. job. But they're it's sort of like stepping stones across a river, right? Today at Editas, there's a different set of investors. It's not the venture investors. But you have to be a responsible steward of the current investors as well. And, you know, you go from maybe seed investing to venture to mezzanine to IPO. That the people that invest in IPOs are very different than the people that invest when, you know, Moderna did their offering right. the other right. week. Those are not the same. You know, some of them will be the same, but a lot of them will be different. So there are these different pools of capital along the way. And at every step, you need to earn your right, literally, to access that new pool. And part of the way you earn your right is you take care of the investors that came before you, but you also have to build a company that is a good investment for that next pool of capital. So that's building for the long term. Being a responsible steward of capital is extremely important. But to me, that's a different framing than exit, because the VCs might be exiting. I wasn't exiting.
Yeah, that's a great point, actually. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, because an exit isn't the end of the company. Yeah.
Nope.
Yeah, but let me ask this in a hypothetical sort of way. Let's just pretend that at Avila, the offer comes in and it's $350 up front, and it looks like for sure a couple of those milestones are going to be easy to hit. So there's like a 10x return for the investors. I'm making this up, of course, but you know, if you were to say we're not doing that merger, would there have been massive pushback against that?
Well, so this is where it's funny, because it was at Nexus, not Avila, but very similar context, that they did an HBS case on it. And, you know, the way they frame these at HBS cases, they're, you know, like the CEO puts the phone down and they kind of stage this little scene. Yeah. And they set up the whole context and everything. And at the end, they have the class debate the question about, do you sell or not? And so the class is debating this whole, like, well, the CEO this and the CEO that, and that, 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 that. And then, you know, then I remember because they have a guest who's part of the company come, and Vicky Sato is teaching the class at the time. And you know, she invites us down and say, so, you know, so what happened? And I'm like, all right, I need everybody to think for a moment about who makes this decision. And there was silence. And I said, it's not a trick question, guys. I mean, this is a very basic corporate governance question. Who makes the decision? Eventually somebody comes up with board of directors. I'm like, right. Like, who's on the board of directors?
Right.
So look, there are absolutely these realities. At Avila, it wasn't my personal decision one way or the other. And certainly when, I still remember the moment when George Golombeski offered me the term sheet after dinner in New York. And, you know, the moment I saw that number, I'm like, and it was a lower number than what we ended up at, but I knew what direction this was going to go. But that's what I mean by, you know, I said earlier, of like on your way to building value, sometimes these things happen, but not just to small companies, right? Big companies get
acquired. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
becoming scared quite all the time, right? You know, think about the years that, you know, Carl Icahn is trying to force Biogen to get acquired, or, you know, when Pfizer acquires Warner Lambert, or, I mean, for example, look at Sanofi. Is a combination of Herx Merian, Rossell, Rhône, Palanc, Roar. And I'm sure there's a bunch of others beyond that. GlaxoSmithKline, Beecham, SmithKline, Beckman, like large companies face this stuff all the time. And you just have to say, you know, what is the right choice for all the stakeholders? And one of the wonderful parts about something like the situation with Celgene was we've been talking to them for quite a while about a potential business development collaboration, and they basically are like, look, if you don't want to do acquisition, we'd still like to do the collaboration. We knew them well. And so you could say, is this a good home for the people and the technology, and will it continue to go forward? We felt good about answering that question. It's not just about the ROI.
Yeah. Maybe the question should have been, you get an offer and you know, you go into the board meeting and three of your board members are leaders of your last three rounds or something, and you go, okay, now this is going to be, I don't know. I have to assume that they're contentious at some point. They must be.
It's, you know, honestly, but this is where I think it depends a great deal on how that board has been developed and cultivated over time, right? In the moment, yes, you'll get all these different reactions, but the quality of that conversation, the candor of it, the how much people are listening to each other, it's not because of what's happening in that moment. It's happening. It's because of what's happened over the last 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years. And so, you know, you can't build a culture in the moment of either crisis or opportunity or event. You know, it'd be same thing like what if you had bad clinical data, or what if there were a global pandemic, or, you know, these kinds of significant events, let's just call them significant events, do happen. And it's both for the board culture as well as the company culture. This is where your culture shows up. You can't mold your culture in the moment, but your culture will show up positively or negatively when these significant events occur. And this is why you need to be working on culture all the time, so that working on it's a normal thing to do. And then, you know, then it's there to lean on when you need it. And that is absolutely what happened at Avalo, was that, you know, it was a wonderful place. Great board members and investors, great organization overall. And yeah, we leaned on each other quite a lot in those moments. And yeah, surely there's some contentious conversations, but it was never disrespectful. It was always candid. And, you know, it was contentious just because it's a big deal. It's emotional. Yeah. You know, it's all of a sudden we're going a new direction, and that's just hard.
So I want to ask about Editas too. So you left Editas about a year ago, I guess March in 2019.
Yeah.
And I mean, so I have no idea what happened, but the word abrupt happened in the media quite often after that. You left abruptly, she left abruptly, whatever. The CMO had left, the CFO had left. And it looked like from the outside, there's some sort of exodus from this really high profile CRISPR company. I mean, was any of that accurate? What happened there?
Well, you know, I think obviously if folks like to try to speculate, read between the lines, whatever. I mean, honestly, it was three quite separate things that happened to come at a similar moment in time. You know, companies do go through these transitions of leadership because there can be sort of phases or eras or chapters of company building. And I think in some respects, that's a little bit more maybe what you saw. And it was frankly kind of, I would say, arbitrary. It was there wasn't any specific reason those things happened in a similar time frame. They just happened to. But I think, you know, one of the things that I felt very strongly about was I would never want to leave a company unless it was in strong shape. And from the perspective of the science and the leaders that were continuing there and the capital, always important for a biotech company. You know, we had a long runway, a very strong and high quality list of investors. And so the company was very healthy. And I think that's essential, because you want, anytime there's transitions, you know, there's a little time to kind of get into that new gear and that new chapter of the company. And so you always want to be leaving leaving it healthy to hand into the hands of a new leader.
I mean, as you said, there are people who will make the trains run on time, and there are people who want to build companies, and you'd been there 5 years.
Yeah, felt like 1,000, but sure, 5 years. there's something about crisper years are different from other years, but no, it was an absolutely fabulous experience. And I think, it's a technology that literally is a once a generation technology.
Yeah.
It just is. And I think, we're still in a good way at the tip of the iceberg of all of the things that will come from the technology. Fundamentally, obviously, is being used in a million different ways in basic research laboratories, and there's new creative variations and versions and applications coming out every day. Fundamentally transformative technology to biological science writ large, in a way that, recombinant DNA and PCR are maybe the other two that, and maybe, anyway, there's very few technologies that are that. And it comes with this additional layer, certainly as we're building Editas, of what's the right way to engage with the public. Because this is not just, most biotech science, it doesn't have these big social implications. The existing ethical framework of how to do clinical trials and how to do research and all that, it just fits, and you don't have to think about new rules because the existing rules are appropriate. With CRISPR, that's still true, and then there was this other gear that genuinely required, demanded finding the right way to engage. Even though we were a tiny little new company, we needed to operate in this sphere that most young biotechs never have to operate in.
Apparently. Yeah, a lot of startups, you can sort of, depending on what investors are behind the company, but a startup will start and it'll be in stealth mode for a little bit and then have a Series A, and you'll have some sort of time to figure yourself out maybe. But this wasn't the case with the CRISPR companies. Everybody knew who the first few were, and everybody's eyes were on it. And it's quite a thing.
Yeah, it was quite a thing. Yeah, no, it was pretty spectacular. I will say probably the most exciting part was just so many times when, you'd see a new piece of data and you'd realize nobody in the world's ever done this before. My God. And sometimes it was positive data and sometimes it was negative data. And you're like, okay, got to solve this one. Because it was just so new. There's a lot of stuff to figure out. And, a lot of times I said to the scientists, like, look, let me be your heat shield. Just you figure out the science. I will
talk to the media.
Give you time and money and, talk to the external world to figure it out, because you just got to get it right.
They see the data and they think there's going to be ripples from this, right? I mean, this isn't just something that's happening in the company. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, and there were a lot of instances. One of the interesting things, too, is that there were also a number of instances where an academic would publish some paper that would say, there's this huge issue with CRISPR of whatever nature. There's a few of these. And, so when those, and oftentimes we kind of knew they were coming because either somebody gave us a heads up or, we happened to be already talking to the investigator, whatever. So I don't think any of them were ever surprises. But when they actually came out, you needed to be able to respond and, thoughtfully. And a lot of these are basic research papers that are, making New York Times articles, which that doesn't happen very often.
I think there's two things I want to ask you, and then I will let you go. But the first one is, it's very, very rare to find somebody who is in the management suite who does not have an MBA or a PhD. Very rare. Almost as if it's an impediment, honestly. I mean, you have to go get, I had one person who was sort of transitioning from the business world over to, he wanted to run a company. And they said, if you don't have a PhD, no one's really going to think you're serious. Right. And so I think my question is, when you look back at the career that you've had, where you honestly started as an administrative assistant, do you think someone could follow that path today and still make it? You think they could, or has the industry changed so much that it's impossible?
Yeah, no, I don't think it's impossible. I think that for every rule, there are exceptions, but more importantly, it's, I did consider going to graduate school a couple different points, and You know, at one point I definitely thought I would get an MBA, or at one point I thought about going to medical school because I'm like, well, God, you know, it'd be wonderful to know all that stuff. And the practical reality was I was always just so engaged with what I was doing at the moment. It's like, well, I can't stop doing this right now because it's too much fun and I like it too much. And, you know, maybe a little bit later. And then I think you do reach a point in life where you're like, yeah, probably graduate school doesn't make sense for me anymore. You know, you're never done learning. And I think particularly in the world of biotech, I mean, I should show you the stack of papers that's on my desk literally right now. I'm looking at them like, I haven't read those papers yet. I need to read those papers. So you're always, always, always learning. And I think that may be, at the end of the day, what matters more than a particular degree. There are absolutely positions where certain credentials or calling cards. I mean, like, nobody's going to hire me to be their chief scientific officer, right? But for a CEO role, there are many different backgrounds that are successful. Right? There's not a single phenotype. There are common phenotypes, but not singular phenotypes.
Yeah, that makes sense. I really don't know if, because there's way more companies and way more jobs now, it's easier to crack the industry now than it was when you were just getting out of college and no one really knew what biotech was.
Yeah. True. That's true. Yeah, but I think that's great. I mean, that's the ultimate success of the industry, is that it's grown so much and that so many young people are excited to get into it. Like, that's fabulous. I still remember, so when I was a senior at Cornell, there was one other person, Doug Onsi, he and I are still good friends, who was also a bio major, and we were like the only two people in the entire, biology is a pretty big major at Cornell, the only two people who had some idea of something other than PhD or medical school. And we were both in Rita Calva's genetics and society class, and we would like walk out of the class talking about the class, and then we would talk about like, oh my God, surely there's a place for us in the world somewhere. And he went to law school and then, you know, became a lawyer doing biotech deals and eventually went into venture capital and worked for companies as well. So we both ended up in biotech, slightly different paths, but, you know, we were the only two at the time. And now, you know, like, they do seminars on how to get into biotech.
Yeah, everything's changed.
Which is fantastic. You know, if people see it as a career. Wow, that's wonderful. That's great. Obviously I'm a little bit biased. We need people to be interested in other things too, but I happen to think biotech is pretty awesome. So, you know, I think that more and more young people being excited to come into biotech is freaking awesome. We need it. There's so much wonderful science. That's the thing, is that the raw material of this industry is science. There is so much wonderful science that is worthy of people investing their lives in to turn it into medicines, to turn it into diagnostics, to turn it into vaccines, and a lot of other things. I mean, I think there's endless creativity. It's really hard. It's not going to be for everybody. It's the daunting, daunting industry. As I often say, you will have these soul-crushing moments, but you'll also have these incredibly uplifting moments. And you know, at the end of the day, when you wake up in the morning and you're standing in front of the mirror and you're brushing your teeth and you're thinking about the day ahead, you have no doubt in your mind about your purpose and the worthiness of what you're engaged in. Like, you don't worry about that. You worry about a lot of other stuff, but you don't worry about that. And that's pretty fundamental.
I think you may have just answered this question, but, you know, given that you sort of, when you got out of college, you knew you wanted to be in biotech, right? And the question is, do you still want to be in biotech? And I would preface that by saying, I assume that some business schools would love to have you on their faculty, for example. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, and I do the occasional lecture, and I do enjoy that. But, you know, I like building stuff. I want to go build more stuff.
So there's the answer.
Yeah, I like building stuff.
Yeah, this has been great. I learned stuff. Thank you. I really appreciate the time.
Oh, my pleasure. It's fun. I mean, you know, we don't often step back and think about how all the pieces of our life link together. But, you know, when you have the opportunity for a conversation like this, you kind of see how some things like, wow, that doesn't really
it all links up.
Okay, there it is, your first Rounders podcast with Katrine Bosley. My thanks to her. I learned a ton of stuff. Love the conversation. Thank you to the Midwest Quiet for use of their music in this podcast and in Forum, our other podcast. They hear their music there. You can find this podcast and subscribe to it wherever you get your podcasts by searching Nature Biotechnology and First Rounders. You can find Forum, our podcast that looks at recent papers published in Nature Biotechnology and elsewhere, and then discusses those papers with leading researchers in the field. You can find that podcast wherever you get your podcasts by searching Nature Biotechnology and Forum. If you'd like to reach us, talk to us, comment on things that we do, you can find us on Twitter. Our handle is @NatureBiotech. And any other housekeeping, not that I can think of. 2020, not my favorite year. Not by a long shot. It's probably not yours either. Maybe it's going to turn around, but we're halfway through it, and it's been terrible. Keep your head above water, and I don't know. If you get a chance, be nice to someone else. Maybe that'll help. Yeah, that is all. I will talk to you later, and goodbye.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.